Copper and Brass Incorporated. Founded by Paul Revere in 1801. Fabricators of copper, copper alloys, and aluminum alloys for home and industry. And makers of the famous Revereware presents Meet the Press. Our guest of the afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, will be Ambassador at Large John Foster Dulles, one of America's leading experts on international affairs. President Truman sent him to Tokyo to speed the peace treaty with Japan the day after he relieved General MacArthur. Mr. Dulles has just returned from that mission, which also included England and France. But before we meet the press, let's meet a few of the Revere products that serve you in some way most every day of your life. When you cheer the champs at the Yankee Stadium, New York, take a few minutes to look up at the frieze and ornamental work overhead. It's made of enduring, non-rusting Revere copper that will last for years and years without repair. When you go stargazing at the Adler Planetarium, Chicago, you'll again find Revere copper, this time as a roof, waging a successful fight against the ravages of time and the elements. When you take a train at New York's famous Grand Central Terminal, a Revere copper roof once more offers you protection and its owners low maintenance costs. When the Senate's in session, Revere again gets the vote, for the new roof on the Senate wing of the U.S. Capitol is of enduring Revere copper. It replaced another copper roof that was still in good condition after 90 years of service. Some of the first copper sheets rolled by Paul Revere when he founded the first copper rolling mill in America 150 years ago were used to roof the State House in Boston, where they remained in service for well over a century. Today, that business founded by Paul Revere in 1801 is known as Revere Copper and Brass Incorporated, oldest independent fabricator of copper and copper-based alloys in the nation. Also important fabricators of aluminum alloys, electric welded steel tube, and famous Revereware. And now, ladies and gentlemen, meet the press, America's press conference of the air. Ready for today's unrehearsed, spontaneous press conference are four of America's top reporters. Please remember that their questions do not necessarily reveal their point of view. It is their way of getting a story for you. Now meet Mr. Tom Hamilton of the New York Times, Mr. Alistair Cook of the English Manchester Guardian, Mr. Marquis Childs of United Features, Mr. Lawrence Spivak of Mercury Publications, a regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Finally, Miss Martha Roundtree, moderator of Meet the Press.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and members of our press panel. Now, Mr. Dulles, if you are ready, I see Mr. Childs has the first question.
Ambassador Dulles, do you attach any significance to the declaration by Jacob Malik that they want a peace, a ceasefire in Korea, want peace, or do you think that's just a propaganda trap for the United States?
Yeah, Mr. Child, it's never possible to tell what the Russians mean from what they say. I've been dealing with them and negotiating with them now for nearly 6 years, and I've learned you've got to look behind what they say to what the deeds are, and I'd make the same caveat here.
Well, don't you think it's rather unusual that here on the anniversary of this start of the Korean War, the United States should have let the Russians take the initiative with that move? Couldn't we have prevented that somehow?
There's no initiative that I know of in trying to get peace in Korea. We've been trying to do that. The aggression started a year ago. We've been trying to stop it. Anybody could stop it who... The Russians could have stopped it any time they wanted to over this period. They can stop it now if they want to. That remains to be seen.
You think their control over communist China is so great they can stop the war when they want to?
I haven't the slightest doubt of it.
Mr. Hamilton.
Ambassador Dulles, could you tell us what technique you would recommend now to find out whether the Russians are really kidding or really want peace?
No, I wouldn't want to give you that, Mr. Hamilton. Somebody else is in charge of that responsibility, and I'm not going to try to muddy the water for him.
Mr. Cook.
Mr. Ambassador, do you see in the text, Mr. Malik's statement, do you see in that text any concession, any admission that the Chinese communists are fighting partners with the North Koreans?
Well, as I recall, the last sentence talks about the belligerents in the plural, and I take it that that implies that there are more than one.
But they say only the... Wouldn't that mean the belligerents on both sides?
Might mean that.
Mr. Spivey?
Mr. Ambassador, is there any question in your mind but that if the Russians are sincere about this ceasefire, that we can have peace in Korea very quickly?
I think those of us who had to deal with the matter, it hadn't been my principal job, have recognized from the beginning that it was the Soviet Union that was pulling the strings. They've been pushing into aggression, and they can pull back from aggression anytime they want.
Well, we're ready. We've indicated, haven't we, in the last few weeks, that we're ready to entertain a reasonable ceasefire truce. And I say again, then, isn't it clear that if the Russians are sincere, and from your experience with them, don't you think that if they are sincere, that we can have a ceasefire within a very short period of time?
The answer to that is one word, yes.
Mr. Charles.
Ambassador Dulles, when Secretary Acheson suggested that the United States would be willing to negotiate on the 38th parallel, quite a few members of your party, the Republican Party, called that appeasement. Do you think that settling the war on the 38th parallel would be accepted by most people in both parties?
I haven't analyzed that situation from a political standpoint closely enough to be able to indicate just what the lineup would be. My own personal opinion is that this effort we're making in Korea is the first effort that's ever been made on a broad international basis to stop aggression. If it does stop the aggression, that will be a great achievement for the principle of collective security.
Even if it is stopped on the former demarcation line?
If you stop it cold, I think you've done enough.
Mr. Cook?
Mr. Ambassador, since Japan is the base of our operations in Korea, is it possible to sign a Japanese peace treaty before the Korean War is over?
Yes, it's not only possible, but I feel pretty confident it's going to happen. There's a difference, Mr. Cook, between signing a peace treaty and having it actually come into force. A peace treaty only comes into force after it's been ratified, an exchange of ratifications and so forth, so that there will inevitably be a delay between the signing of a peace treaty and its coming into force. During that period, I might say, that the SCAP controls and so forth will continue from a legal standpoint unchanged.
Mr. Hamilton.
Mr. Ambassador, I think that the Russians, in particular Mr. Malik, as of yesterday, are charging that we, in the peace treaty, are looking forward to the revival of Japanese militarism. Could you tell us, I believe the treaty does not put in limitations on the size of Japanese armed forces. Could you tell us the answer to that one?
Yes, the treaty does not put any limitation upon the future armament because we largely feel that that's a useless kind of a provision. You take today, the treaties we made a few years ago with Bulgaria, Hungary, and Romania all had those provisions in, and today we know they're being grossly violated. But there is no revival of Japanese militarism. I've seldom been in any country in all my life where there was a little evidence of militarism as there is in Japan today. They haven't got enough to maintain a decent home police force. And there's no desire. They've got a constitution, you know, which prevents their having any army at all.
Mr. Spivey.
Well, Mr. Dulles, you've been in Japan recently and have had some first-hand reports on Korea. Do those reports suggest strongly to you that maybe the Chinese communists have gotten such punishment that there may be a great deal more sincerity to the speech of Malik's than we credit it?
It's always very interesting and intriguing to speculate about what's in the back of the minds of the Russians. I don't know it's a very profitable thing to do.
Be interesting, though.
It's interesting. And just as a matter of speculation, one can think of several theories. One theory is that they are under such pressure from the Chinese that they're in somewhat of a dilemma. They probably don't want to do everything that the Chinese want them to do, and that is a possibility which may have prompted this statement.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, you've had considerable experience with the Russians. When someone like Malik makes a speech, he doesn't just make it carelessly and off the cuff, does he?
No, I think that every formal statement of the Russians is as carefully tailored in the Kremlin as it can possibly be. Every word has been weighed and appraised. Now, I've dealt with them, as you say, a great deal. You read this statement of Malik's, 99% of what he says is the old tune that Gromyko has been playing every day for 3 months in Paris. Now, you may say that people got tired listening to the cracked record, and so to make people listen, they've put in a little Philip to make it better propaganda. That's one theory. As I say, there are half a dozen theories you can evolve. It's interesting to speculate about them. Somebody's got to try them out, and in the course of time, we'll find out which one's right.
Well, there are two. On this particular thing, there can be only two things. Either they are sincere, or they're using their old propaganda trick again. Now, what? That's been played over and over again so often. What purpose will it serve once more to play the old record again? Who's going to
every
fool?
Every time they play it, they catch a few more suckers.
Do you think they're looking for suckers? Where?
Certainly they are.
Where?
Among the poor people of the world who want peace and think the Russians are the ones that'll give it to them. They've pulled off the most fabulous propaganda exploit of history, where they're the ones that are conducting war, preparing for war, and still through propaganda leading many innocent people to think that they're the ones that love peace. And as long as they can get away with that, they're going to go on trying.
Well, your judgment then is that we can't pay too much attention to this speech until we get something official, either through the UN or through the Chinese Communists or through the North Koreans.
My judgment is that you can adopt any one of a dozen hypotheses as to what they really mean, and only the events of the coming days and weeks will prove which is right.
Well, what would be the step if they were sincere? Would it go through the UN?
Well, now you're in a field I can't answer on, because I'm not working on the UN now.
Mr. Charles.
Getting back to the Japanese treaty, Ambassador Dulles, how did you persuade the British to give up their claim for the 200 million of Japanese gold, or part of it, and go along without any reparations from Japan?
Well, I showed them that the United States had a pretty good claim to decide the future of that gold. During this period of occupation, the United States has advanced $2 billion to keep Japan's economy alive. Any time we could have used that $200 million of gold to pay for Japanese imports and cut down by that much the amount of our advances. In other words, we've bought that gold 10 times over. Therefore, I think we have some right to say what becomes of it.
And what about the Japanese assets in Europe? Who's to get those?
Well, in general, under the treaty, it's contemplated that Japanese assets in Allied powers will be taken. In fact, they have been taken by the Allied powers themselves. That covers most of Europe.
I noticed in the paper today that the Philippines are not willing to give up their claim on $8 billion of reparations. Don't you think, in view of the terrible devastation of that country, that they're entitled to something?
They're not only entitled to something, but they've already had a great deal.
From Japan or from us?
From us as an advance on Japan's account. For instance, we put in $550 million as advance reparation payments to the Philippines, with the understanding that that would be repaid to us out of any cash reparation payments that were made by the Japanese.
But we're not
in addition to that, we have put in, according to different calculations, anywhere from around $2 billion or more dollars, depending upon what value you
but
get
we aren't
surplus
get
war
that,
material.
We aren't going to get that back from Japan, are we?
I don't believe so. But if there are reparation payments from Japan, we are legally entitled to it to that extent before the Philippines.
Do you think we will insist upon any?
We don't think that the Japanese are in a position to pay much reparations unless the United States goes on putting up the money. As I pointed out, we have already put up, during the 5.5 years of occupation, $2 billion to help Japan meet her balance of payments, import the foods and raw materials that she needs to keep her economy going and to keep communism out. Now, if you're going to add on top of that a lot of reparations, either Japan's going to go communist or else we're going to pay the bill.
Mr. Hamilton.
I'd like to ask you, Mr. Ambassador, what about the possibility that the Japanese government will end up by insisting upon trading with communist China by recognizing communist China? I gather that the treaty would leave the Japanese government, in effect, free to decide who would they recognize, whether it be the communist government or the nationalist government. How does that fit in with our policy?
The treaty, when it becomes effective, will, I hope and believe, restore Japan as a sovereign nation. And like any other sovereign nation, she'll have the right to conduct her own foreign affairs. Now, as far as who she deals with, that will depend a great deal, I suppose, upon future events. At the present time, the Japanese government has very close relations with the national government, and the trade between Formosa and Japan is very vigorous. It's, in fact, gone back virtually to the pre-war basis, as it was when Formosa was a Japanese colony.
I just wanted to ask particularly about What about trading with the mainland of China?
There's a certain amount of trade with the mainland that goes on. It's mostly illicit trade, in the sense that it's not done through the Communist Central Trading Organization. And I doubt very much if there will be trade through that organization, because that's a very difficult organization to deal with, and they'll want the kind of things that I don't think the Japanese will want to give them or wouldn't be permitted to give them under the United Nations resolutions as they now stand.
Mr. Cook.
Sir, isn't the the real obstacle to Japan's being a prosperous and firm ally their real need for heavy trade with China? I mean, the real reason why they went into Manchuria, their lack of anthracite and iron ore and all the other things. Wouldn't the Kem Amendment make them a permanent economic dependent of the United States?
Japanese, in my opinion, did not go into Manchuria because they had to be dependent, for instance, on raw material from Manchuria. They used to get their raw material very largely from other places. They got their iron ore very largely from the Philippines and from Malaya. Now, the reason they went into Manchuria was, in the 30s, they were afraid that the League of Nations was going to impose sanctions against them, economic sanctions. And they knew that then they'd be vulnerable if they depended upon overseas areas, which they had been dependent upon. So they tried to get Manchuria so as to have a base which would not be vulnerable to sanctions. It was not an economic move, it was a political move.
But as I recall, sir, didn't the Diet say something about in 1931 that if they were forced to get their raw materials from American or European powers in the Far East, that they were consigned to a state of, they call it, permanent inferiority? And wouldn't that apply if they can't?
That is not the mood of the Japanese today.
I see.
Mr. Spivak?
Mr. Dulles, before MacArthur was relieved, you were in Japan, and I believe discussed with him Japanese peace terms.
That's right.
Are the terms that you and the British and the French have agreed upon in line with what General MacArthur thinks on the subject?
Yeah, very closely so. We've got a very remarkable demonstration, at least so far, of bipartisan cooperation in this matter. I've had absolutely complete backing from the president, and also the program we've been working on has been a program which, in the first instance, I worked out very largely with General MacArthur in Tokyo a year ago.
What was the reaction in Japan to the change in command? I believe you were there at the time.
Well, I went there immediately. President Truman asked me to go there the day following the announcement of the relief of General MacArthur. And I did go in a day or two. The Japanese people were rather bewildered. They're not quite used to our quick action methods in those respects. And it took a little explaining to make them realize that what had happened involved a change of personalities, but did not involve a change of the basic principles upon which we were operating. I think I satisfied them that the principles that which we'd worked out with General MacArthur, which had been endorsed by the administration, the principles stood firm. And that was reassuring to them.
You seem to have been in Japan at almost every psychological moment. I believe you were in Japan when the Korean War broke out, too.
I was, just exactly a year ago today.
Can you give us any idea what MacArthur said at that time when the war broke out and what his plans were about fighting it?
Well, originally there was some question in the minds of the staff in Tokyo as to whether this offensive was a genuine major war effort, or whether it was only a raid in force, such as had been going on quite frequently. I'd been up to the 38th parallel myself just two or three days before, and that very day there'd been a raid across the parallel from the north, and a few people had been killed. That type of thing, on a larger scale or smaller scale, had been going on off and on. So nobody knew whether this, when it first broke, was a real war, or whether it was merely a raid from which they would retire. And by the time I left Tokyo on Tuesday, and by that time it seemed that the thing was developing into a full-scale war.
Did he feel at that time that this not only was a major war, but that it was one of our major fronts?
I think he did, yes.
May I switch for a moment to China?
Just a moment now. Mr. Charles, did you want to pursue that?
Well, I wanted to switch even further for just a moment to another part of the world.
Well, switch.
then let's
when go. You were in Paris the other day, you talked with General Eisenhower, Mr. Ambassador.
Yeah.
Did he seem encouraged by the development of the North Atlantic defenses, or, as some reports have it, was he discouraged?
I would say that he was in an intermediate stage between discouragement and encouragement.
He didn't.
He realized that it was a long, hard job, that the problems of nationalism still survive, and that it's a slow business to meld together all these forces into a single cohesive unit. I mostly talked with General Eisenhower not about his problems, but about mine. I wanted to give him, and the President wanted me to give him, a picture of what was going on the other side of the world in relation to China and Japan, so that I did more of the talking than perhaps I should have.
He didn't get around to telling you whether he'd accept a Republican nomination for the presidency if he was offered it, did he?
No, we didn't get around to that.
You sure you didn't talk about that at all?
Now, Mr. Spivak, I'll let you finish.
Is China going to be consulted on this treaty, Mr. Ambassador?
We have consulted very fully with the national government, and they have made very many constructive suggestions, which we've adopted. The Chinese national government has had a full part in the preparation of this peace treaty, as any government has had, and it played a very constructive role. Now, in contrast, you can see what happened to the so-called People's Government. The Soviet Union gave them a draft of our peace treaty, and at the same time, the Soviet Union wrote a note about it. And then they asked the People's Government what they thought about it. You'd be very much surprised, no doubt, to find that the People's Government, the Communist Government, wrote back to the Soviet Union and said, "We absolutely agree with everything that you have said about the peace treaty."
Everything,
and they made no single suggestion of their own.
Everything the Soviet has said?
The People's Government said that we agree completely with everything that the Soviet Union has said about the peace treaty.
Which is what? That it isn't any good.
Yeah. But the point was, Mr. Spivak, that whereas the national government made a number of constructive suggestions from the standpoint of China, which were worthy of acceptance and which we did accept, the People's Government showed that it was merely a puppet government because it had no independent view whatever to express about China, and merely said, "The People's Government of China agrees completely with everything that has been said by the Soviet government," and then they went on and repeated verbatim practically everything the Russians had said.
Well, where does this put the British, which recognize the communist China?
Well, it's true they recognize the communist regime, the People's Republic, but the People's Republic has not yet deigned to receive the British ambassador, so that they're not on very good talking relations.
So that the British have agreed with you, then, that the nationalists are the ones to be consulted on this treaty rather than...
No, I wouldn't say that they've agreed to that. We have, in our own handling of this treaty, have gone about it in the normal way of consulting the governments concerned that we had diplomatic relations with. And we did that on our own initiative, and nobody said nay. We didn't ask anybody's permission to do it.
Mr. Cook.
Sir, when you were in Paris the other day, there was a story came out of there, printed in a couple of American papers, that the British wanted to perpetuate the Far Eastern Commission. Now, that was not so, wasn't it, was it?
No, that was inaccurate.
Thank you, sir.
All right, Mr. Spivak, I'll let you finish that other question.
Mr. Dulles, you were one of Governor Dewey's closest advisors. What significance do you attach to this trip of his to Korea to see for himself? Isn't it a rather strange trip for an unusual one for a governor to take?
No, I don't think so. Governor Dewey made a trip to Europe, I think, 2 years ago, and he's never been in the Far East. This is not just a trip to Korea. Doubt if he spends much time in Korea. It's a trip which he'll swing all through the Pacific Southeast Asia area. I mean, it'll be Japan, Korea, Formosa, Indochina, Australia, New Zealand, Philippines.
Do you attach any political significance to it at all?
No.
Do you think governors, have any other governors taken trips like this?
I think that I know that many governors go there, many senators go there. I suppose at least half of the senators have been out on such a trip during the last couple of years. And I think that any American citizen who wants to keep himself well informed and has the opportunity to do so ought to go not only to Europe, as Governor Dewey has done and as most people do, but they ought to go also to the East, go to Asia and the Pacific.
Mr. Hamilton.
Mr. Ambassador, as I understand it, the draft peace treaty doesn't provide what's to be done with Formosa. It just says that Japan has to give up its rights to it. At the United Nations, there's still a lot of discussion about the possibility of making it a United Nations trusteeship, possibly with the United States to administer it. Could you give us your personal views on that?
No, I can only say that you're correct that the Japanese peace treaty, if it goes into effect as now drafted, would merely take the Japanese out of the picture. and it would not in any way attempt to prejudge what the future of Formosa will be.
There's no way of knowing what's to be done with Formosa, now or later?
No, it is on the agenda still of the General Assembly. As I recall, I was supposed to handle it at the General Assembly last fall.
It's still in session.
It got a little too hot to handle.
Mr. Childs.
Ambassador Dulles, what about the communist threat inside Japan? I understand that many people think that's much more serious than General MacArthur does, for example.
Well, I wouldn't want to attempt to say what General MacArthur thinks about it. I did have a very full talk with General Willoughby, who is his principal intelligence officer, when I was in Japan this last time, which is 6 weeks ago. And from that, I feel that there is a considerable communist threat there. At the present time, they're carrying on a very violent war of nerves against this peace treaty, and they're threatening the Japanese that if they make a peace treaty, that may be the occasion for an invasion by Russia. That's part of the peace talk that we don't hear about when they talk over the United Nations.
You spoke a little earlier about timing. I understand that some Japanese businessmen think this treaty will be enforced
by
August.
Mr. Charles, that's going to be a good question, but I don't think it's fair. Mr. Dulles, for me to let you finish asking it because our time is up. This concludes our latest edition of Meet the Press. Thank you, Ambassador John Foster Dulles, for being with us. And now a word about next week's guest.
Tune in next Sunday when Revere Copper and Brass Incorporated will again present Meet the Press. Our guest will be David Lilienthal, who was head of the Atomic Energy Commission from its inception until he resigned. He has played a major role in the development of atomic energy in this country. Starting next Sunday, July 1st, Meet the Press will be presented at a new time over most of these stations. Consult your local newspaper for time and channel. And now, good afternoon for Mr. Tom Hamilton, Mr. Alistair Cook, Mr. Marquis Childs, Mr. Lawrence Spivak, Miss Martha Roundtree, Ambassador John Foster Dulles. You've met the press. Now meet Revereware, that line of famous copper-clad stainless steel cooking utensils made by Revere Copper and Brass Incorporated.